I went and I had to borrow half a year's salary. I suppose in some ways, like the sort of Brian Clough of program directors, he was the greatest. What the hell have I done? Nobody resigns from Radio 1.
Conversations, an occasional Radio Moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. Paul McKenna.
So I grew up in North London. My father was a builder. My mother she was a teacher. She's retired now. Early childhood was really quite happy until later when I went to Catholic school. And that was very unhappy. I went to a school like Grange Hill, you know, it was a regular normal school. I liked football, you know, I played for my school. I always had a sense of humour. I'm a practical joker. I always found it easy to relate to people. I knew when I was young I was going to be famous. Even when I was like, you know, like 7 or 8 years old, I just knew I'd be famous when I grew up. And I thought it would be in the area of... Well, I thought first I might be a rock star or something like that. But I then realised it was in the area of communication, but I didn't know how. Even when I was at school, we put on like a play. I impersonated everybody, so I impersonated one of the teachers, and I just did him. And the whole school was roaring with laughter. I mean, I wasn't trying to be mean. It was a sort of sincerest form of flattery sort of impersonation. I thought, maybe, you know, people do sort of think I've got a sense of humour. See, because I believe everyone's got actually a sense of humour, but not everyone tells jokes well. I think humour's really important to me. I mean, I laugh every day. I remember doing a health expo in Dubai with Deepak Chopra, and this brilliant doctor from India, medical doctor, he explained how laughter is so important for our health. And then he got everyone to pull faces at each other, and we were falling about laughing. So I think I like to laugh a lot.
It starts.
So, yeah, as a kid, what happened? Somebody had an album, and it was sort of history of pirate radio. So there were recordings of Radio Caroline, Radio London, you know, and I was intrigued by it.
Tell them the time, Kenny, tell them the time.
You want me to tell them, Sam, by our new Boulevard Accutron watch?
Bang, bang,
this,
yes.
This great thing that whirls around in front of us exactly 22 minutes until 6 o'clock, oh. And you can check that by Jim or Tim or whatever his name is.
I also was fascinated by the story, you know, that there was an hour of pop music allowed a week. And it was basically Harold Wilson was trying to turn this country into communist Russia. And this brilliant, ballsy Irishman called Ronan O'Reilly had the guts to start his own radio station. Because he managed some bands, he couldn't get the records played, so he thought he'd start his own station. And he did, and of course, then what happened was loads of other radio stations started, and half the country was listening to pirate radio stations, not the BBC, and so they had to outlaw it, which made it even more exciting as far as I was concerned.
Summertime
with the 3 o'clock thrill. A friend of mine said, hey, check out this new radio station, Capital Radio, and I loved it, I thought it sounded brilliant. And they had a competition it was an artistic thing, to draw something.
One, two, three.
So I noticed they had a slot called the Young DJ slot. So I just sent my drawing in, because I was thinking I was going to be an artist, and I put this note on saying, would I have a go at your Young DJ spot? And I got home from school a few nights later, and David Briggs, who was later to become my boss, was on the phone saying, hey, do you want to come on up to the Euston Tower? I mean, I can still remember it like it was yesterday. Walked up that magnificent staircase, met Maggie Norton, and then was taken to the studio. The Capital Radio studios were all around a central master control. I could see Roger Scott on the air across from me. You know, I could see Dave Cash in another studio doing something. And they sat me down, and I'd never done it before. They said, when the light comes on, you speak. So the light came on, and I said, hello, this is Paul McKenna. I'm your young DJ for the week, blah, 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 blah. And they said, well, you're a natural. And I said, well, what do you mean? They said, your voice sounds great, but you speak naturally. We didn't have to teach you how to do it or anything. And I went, oh, that's good. And so I started listening to Kenny Everett. And I became, you know, really quite just fascinated by Kenny. And I decided to, when I was probably about 14, 15, I'd go up and wait outside. And he was really kind to me. And eventually he allowed me to sit in and watch him.
Dave Edmonds, Girls Talk. Is that in the charts? I don't know. Well, it jolly well should be. 30 minutes past 12 o'clock right at the moment. What do you think about Wales?
And also, another person that was very kind to me, because my grandfather lived in Suffolk, was Andy Archer. I walked into the Radio Orwell foyer one day, me and my brother and my auntie, and I said, look, is there any chance we could have a tour of the radio station? He said, yeah, okay. And then he let me sit in and watch him. And then another person that was kind to me was a guy called Tom, with the wonderful Tommy Vance. My father somehow knew somebody at BFBS. It got me the opportunity to sit in and watch Tommy.
Paul and Oates, and she's gone. I think we ought to follow that record up with this. It's called Lonely Days and Lonely Nights, and the guy who puts it
so
together...
So basically, I got a masterclass watching Kenny Everett, Tommy Vance and Andy Archer as a, you know, a 14, 15-year-old kid. Then I agreed to mow the lawn and do everything. My mother gave me enough money to buy a little tape machine. I started making my own tapes. And I thought, I know, I'll apply to the local hospital radio station. I went down to meet them and went, you're too young, kid, you know. And I felt a bit rejected. So a few days later, one of my friends, we were up in London. We found ourselves in Oxford Circus. And I walked into Topshop and I realised they had a DJ. And I went and talked to the DJ, a guy called Steve Collins. And he was really nice to me. He let me sit in and watch him. And eventually he said, look, I'm going to let you practice in the studio. And before long, I actually got a job as the Saturday DJ at Topshop. And so while my friends were off stacking shelves, I was playing records, surrounded by pretty girls. As you went down under the escalator, there was this studio, had a window so people could come in and wave at you. We had a little Allen & Heath mixer, I think it was, two Garrard turntables. But by the way, they upgraded that soon. We got a really nice mixer. I'm trying to think what it was. Might have been an Alice or something like that. Actually, we had some SP-10s at one stage, which still fantastic turntables. I mean, not just in terms of they were instant start, but just the look of them. They were so chic. I decided, as jingles had always been my passion, you know, ever since I was a kid, back in those days when I was like 15 or 16, I would sit with my little Grundig machine and make jingles. You know, sometimes I'd play them to Kenny Everett, and I'd take them up, and he'd go, that's good, and he'd give me some advice about it, or that works better this way. And I remember one day this guy who was a mobile DJ rang me up. He says, I hear you can make jingles, mate. I said, yeah, what do you want? He said, right, so give me your name, give me what your disco thing's about, whatever it is. And there was Rapper's Delight, were the first sort of popular rap song. And so what I did was I took this rap beat and I spoke over it and then I double-tracked it so it sounded like, you know, and I did put some of the phase effect on my voice. And this guy came around and I played it to him. I said, what do you think? He went, oh my God, mate, that is brilliant. And he took out 20 quid, right, which seemed like all the money in the world at the time. And he says, that is fantastic, so professional. And I thought, God, I'm just this kid. I got no idea. Well, and so I started making jingles for people. So, and that was something I continued to do. You know, I had a little company that put DJs into different shopping centres and stores and things like that. And at weekends, I went off to work on a pirate, land-based pirate called Radio Sovereign, because I'd become friends with Crispin St. John. And he said to me, hello, Shag. He said, Shag, come on, we've got to set up our own little pirate station.
Solid Gold, Radio Sovereign.
And I knew of these land-based pirates like Radio Jackie and the legendary stories of them running with the transmitter in a biscuit tin across fields being chased by Rick Gotts on a Saturday afternoon. And it all sounded great fun. So I said, yes. So I went down and worked at Radio Sovereign on the weekends and, of course, got raided and busted by the legendary Eric Gotts. In fact, I was very amused by one day the Radio Jackie boys set up a station called Gotts FM and every DJ on it was called Eric Gotts. So they would go, hey, coming up next is Eric Gotts. And later today, Eric Gotts to annoy the living daylights out of him. So I was in Radio Sovereign for a while. And all the time, I'm getting much more experience. And then I worked on Radio Jackie for a little while. And then Radio Caroline came back in, I think it was 83 or something like that. I tried as hard as I could. And then eventually, one day, I got the call. And I had to go to this this little shop in Covent Garden. And I met the legendary Ronan O'Reilly.
The report that had come out, the government report that had come out in 1962, to say there was absolutely no evidence that there was any need for all-day music station, was just complete and absolute hogwash.
I love Ronan. I think he's fantastic. I mean, he's a man with vision. I remember, because it was all clandestine, so it was illegal. So what was the shop? What did it do? It was a Formica shop, something. It sold something or other. So that was the front. But actually, he was running Radio Caroline from there. He was very into, he was like a hippie, very into loving awareness. And I said, so what is loving awareness? He said, well, what do you think it is, Paul? And I said, I don't know, maybe it's sending out a good vibe. Maybe it's like being in this nice, peaceful place and you're spreading that out to other people. He goes, then that's what it is. It was kind of hip, you know.
From a point at sea to the circles in your mind, this is the new Radio Caroline.
I told my parents, I said, I was 20 years old, right? I said, look, I'm going to go work on this radio station. My friend Peter Quinn had just come back. And I said, do you think I should do it, Peter? He goes, God, yes. He said, it's so much fun. Plus, probably the biggest radio station in Western Europe right now. And Eastern Europe as well, because they didn't have pop radio in what was then the communist countries. So everyone's listening to Caroline. I said, look, I can't tell you where I'm going. This is all secret. But I'm going to this boat. And my mum and dad said, well, let us know that you're all right by playing a particular song each day, which I then did. It was the Cars, who's gonna drive you home. Who's gonna drive you home tonight? I can't tell you how exciting it was. Meet at this train station, and we got down to Harwich. And we all got on this little shipping boat, and it took ages to get out. So we were 18 miles off the coast. And then this magnificent ship is on the horizon, and we get on the board the Ross Revenge. I can't say how excited I was. And so only been there about half an hour, about an hour actually, and it gotten dark. And suddenly the generator packed up, and I thought, oh, hang on a minute. I can see all the other ships, the other lights, but they can't see us. Crikey. And I got a little scared, but we had to go down into the bowels of the ship and get the generator going again. In fact, one night, I remember a boat bumped into us when the generator went off, and they were really apologetic. They gave us a load of fish. And the Rainbow Warrior used to come alongside sometimes and fuel us up. The Rainbow Warrior was the Greenpeace ship that those French bastards sank. It was, you know, the proper eco warriors kind of boat. It was amazing. Next to us, there was an American radio station called Laser, which was only American jocks.
From the MV communicator in international waters.
Laser 558.
Well, they didn't take it quite as seriously as we did, because, you know, Radio Caroline wasn't just a radio station. It was like a movement. As far as I saw, it was a freedom of speech movement. You had total free play. You could play whatever you wanted. I played Stairway to Heaven. Then I went into Ella Fitzgerald, I Get a Kick Out of You, and then played Weather Report, Birdland. So it was a fairly eclectic mix. I just remember the first time opening the microphone, they had this, what happened is they bought this country and western station, all the kit from it, and stuck it, you know, on board the Ross and made a studio. And you looked out to sea. It was a beautiful view. It was amazing. So as you're listening to these great tracks, it wasn't a faders desk, it's a POTS. So I'd never used one of these before. And I still remember opening the pot and hearing my voice and thinking, my God, I'm on Radio Caroline. I mean, this is just extraordinary, and getting like goosebumps.
Bob B, socks and the blue jeans, not too young to get married. I'll play that one for you if you've got hitched today, or if you're getting hitched shortly, because Saturdays is the day for that. Van Morrison and Bright Side of the Road, and it was First Light, which we very cleverly mixed with that new single from Marseille Marceau, and that was called Daybreak. It's 3:15. Good afternoon. This is McKenna with you till 6 on Caroline.
Nice, it was a lot of pranks. Things like, I remember we had one bathroom shower, because this was, you know, it was an old Icelandic trawler, beautiful ship actually. When I went in to use the shower, they locked me in, so I climbed out of the porthole, climbed down the superstructure of the ship, went and got a big bucket of water, came up behind them where they were all laughing about me being locked in, and threw a bucket of water over everyone. Of course, then that started a water fight. Everyone on board the ship was chucking water till about 3 a.m. right? People said, did you ever get bored? I went, bored? There was always something to do, and if not, there was always some fun being had. So I was there for about 5 weeks. I thought, this is it. All I want to do is this. And I came ashore, and my friend Tony West, he was working at Chiltern Radio, and he said, look, Paul, the breakfast show DJ is away. You know, they're looking for someone to sit in. you know, do you think you've something you'd like to do? I said, frankly, I really want to go back to the ship. But you know, I met Phil Fothergill, who's a lovely man and, you know, still a dear friend of mine. And he said, look, this chap who was doing the breakfast show, they didn't know had actually gone to prison for, and forgot to tell them. So what was supposed to be sitting in for a few weeks suddenly turned into a couple of months.
Hot FM, first thing in the morning, and McKenna with you here, and stand by for the oldies and your horoscopes coming up.
I really quite like doing the breakfast show because one of the things, I remember Declan Meehan telling me, he said, when you play that record at 8 o'clock in the morning, it sounds so good. By 5 o'clock in the afternoon, it's not quite the same, right? And also, it's the most prestigious show on the station because it's got the biggest listenership. It wasn't so much pressure, it was a thrill. Phil Fothergill and Colin Mason really quite liked American radio, as did I. I was very much a fan of American format radio, and I liked the jingles, I liked the slickness of it. Phil let us get away with a lot. I mean, eventually, you know, we persuaded them that there was the Optimod had only just become available. And we had one on the Caroline ship, and I said, we've got to get one. Basically, an Optimod compresses and limits at various frequencies. It's, processing is the other way of talking about it. So it's kind of like monosodium glutamate for sound. It just makes the sound like fat and thump at you and but brightens it at the same time. But our, like all engineers, our lovely chief engineer, he wanted a thing called dynamic range. Now, that's fine if it's Radio 4 or something, Radio 3. But with a pop station, you don't want the needle to move. You want it just to be smashed at 5 all the time. And so he kept setting it up, so I had too much dynamic range. And Tom Hardy was the head of music. He knew someone at KISS in Los Angeles, which was, you know, frankly, the gold standard for a CHR. That's a contemporary hit radio, top 40 radio station. We got the settings from KISS, and we called ourselves the Optimod Hit Squad, and we broke in one night and cranked this thing, this beast up, so that we sounded loud and fat on the dials.
McKenna in the morning, Chilton 97.
And, you know, having modelled myself to some extent on Kenny Everett, a bit on Tommy Vance, a bit on Andy Archer, and a bit on Steve Collins. Loved Rick Dees as well. I thought he was great. In the 80s, I went to KISS, and one of the laser chaps who I'd become friends with, Dave Cheney, arranged for me to have the tour of the KISS FM studios. And they were in the skyscraper that looked out across Los Angeles. Rick Dees had his own studio. He was the highest paid DJ in the world at the time.
Seven 47, 13 minutes until 8 o'clock right now.
And they had these amazing jam jingles. And I thought, God, I either want to work here or do the Breakfast on Radio 1. But that's my goal, if you like. And funnily enough, I had this conversation with Ryan Seacrest. He said that he did the same thing as a kid. He went to see KISS and he went, that's my goal. I'm going to do that show someday. And indeed, he does to this day. So what happened was I'd got ambition, right? And at the same time, one day I'd had a really bad day, actually. Things were not going well. I'd broken up with my girlfriend. Plus, I'd had an argument with somebody, and I was quite worked up. And I went to interview the local hypnotist. And he said to me, because I was asking him about it, he goes, let me do it to you, because you look like you need some. And I went, oh, knock yourself out, you know. And I was kind of interested in meditation and Zen Buddhism and, you know, those sorts of things. Anyway, I felt so profoundly relaxed and unburdened. I said, look, have you got any books on this? And he lent me a book by Richard Bandler, who was later to become my most prolific teacher in this area. And so these friends of mine had a pub. And I said, oh, I'm really interested in, I'm started doing hypnotism. You know, I'd be just hypnotizing my friends at a party, things like that. And they said, put it on in the pub. Anyway, I put on a hypnotism show, 50 people showed up. And it went great. The next week, about 100 people were there, and then there was queues around the block. And so I thought maybe I should try and do it in a theatre. And at that time, I was, you know, I was really getting interested in it. I was doing it in pubs and clubs. And I'd always wanted to work for Richard Park because I'd heard, you know, about this amazing Scots guy that ran Radio Clyde, and he was, you know, he was this phenomenal motivator, and, you know, he was like, he was a legend. And my friend Pat Sharp had just gone to work at Capital. And Pat said, come on in, Paul. And so I went in to see Pat. And then someone said, Richard Park wants to see you in the offices. He goes, Polly, I've been listening to you, you know, and I quite like what I hear. So there might be a place for you here. You know, I'd heard about Richard Richard Park. I suppose in some ways, like the sort of Brian Clough of programme directors, he was the greatest. I mean, I still believe Richard Park's the greatest radio programmer of all time. I mean, if you look at his track record, I mean, it's brilliant. He's a very intuitive person, actually, I would say. Incredibly loyal, a little intimidating in as much as he's a very strong personality. I was in awe of him. I still am, actually. I think he's an amazing person. Actually, sorry, when he joined Capital, it was not doing very well. And he turned the whole thing around, but he had a vision. You know, he said to me, he goes, Paul, you've got to be a team player, you know. And so he would have these meetings, and you would come out of the meeting and you would be so fired up thinking, I am working for the greatest radio station in the world. And I remember at the time, I remember meeting Mark Goodyear, who'd worked for Richard. And he goes, how are you finding it? I said, Mark, I feel like working for Capital Radio is like playing for Man United. We're a team, so it's not a personality station. Although Chris Tarrant was, without doubt, the biggest personality on the station. And it was so brilliant, it was untrue. You know, the rest of us had to play within the rules of his format, which was quite right. So, you know, he had a particular sound musically, particular styles of links, great American jingle package. And of course, if you made a mistake, he's not shy in telling you. But it wasn't that you were scared of getting fired. I always felt bad about letting him down because he inspired so much. I was always terrified of making a mistake. So I thought, oh my God, this would just be so amazing. But I feel torn because I'm really like enjoying doing the hypnotism. But Capital Radio, my dream, you know, from when I used to stand outside and ask Kenny Everett questions as a kid. And I thought, you know, if I was going to work anywhere, my goal was the Breakfast Show on Radio 1 because of the sort of the, not just the stages, but also the sound of it. I was very much a personality DJ. And the show that I got was I took over from Kenny Everett on a Saturday afternoon. And I'd never been nervous broadcasting in my life, but the pressure was too much. I couldn't handle it because my hands would shake and things like this because I thought Kenny would have been so funny by now. Kenny would have been doing this. Basically, it was a stupid way to think. I remember one of the producers, a guy called Roy Jones, saying, you know, Paul, every one of them, Pat, Jackie Brambles, Lynn Parsons, all of the new people in, all went through the same thing. Don't worry. I'm sure you'll be okay.
95.8 FM is Capital, London's music power, and the top 10 at 10 with Wham at number 4 and Billy Ocean at number 5.
So my job at the Capital was to sit in for the DJs that were away on holiday and to do this show on a Saturday. So there I am on FM, Kenny Everett's on AM. I'd become really good friends with Kenny by then, you know, and we used to socialise a lot. Not only he was so funny, I mean proper funny. Right, to the point where you'd have to say, can you just stop for a minute? Because I can't get my breath. You know, I decided, what I'd do is I found this studio that no one was using. It was a control room studio for, and it had two beautiful Studer A80s in it and a Neve desk. And I cleared all the junk out because people just stuck junk in there. And I decided that was going to be my studio. And I started making jingles, station idents, and jingles for the other DJs. And then Richard said, I like this, Paul, more of this, you know. And the other DJs within the company said, could you make me jingle for this and that? Oh, yeah, of course. And so I would go in at about 11 o'clock in the morning and I would leave at about 11 o'clock at night. All I wanted to do all day long was just make jingles or be on the air, you know? And I thought, this is the greatest radio station I've ever worked at. I think if I had to pick a favourite, it would be Capital Radio. I mean, if I could walk up that staircase one more time, you know, and just that beautiful staircase and then down the corridors and into those studios. And of course, I'd be sitting there cutting things with a razor blade, marking the tape with the China graph. My fingers would usually be cut to pieces. But I'd make these extraordinary sounding productions. From the center of the city, 95.8, Capital FM. At the time, I was very interested in, sort of, I used to read a lot of pop psychology, and there was a question that American motivational speakers use, which is, what would you do if you knew you couldn't fail? I thought, where was I 5 years ago? Where am I now? And where will I be in 5 years' time? And I suddenly got, in 5 years' time, I'll have progressed in radio. I'll be older. I'll be balder. I'll be more paranoid. And I'm not sure if that's where I want to be. So I asked myself this question that the American motivational speakers ask, which is, what would you do if you knew you couldn't fail? So I suddenly got this, it was like a vision. I thought, I'd be doing hypnotism. I'd be on television. I'll make self-improvement cassettes, it was in those days. I'll work with all kinds of people, from sports, from the arts, from business. I'll be world famous, I suppose. And I've got to say, much as I was loving being on the radio, I was basically DJ by day, hypnotist by night. And so I knew that we owned a theatre, right? So I thought, how am I going to make this happen? And I was walking down Tottenham Court Road one day, and I suddenly, I got like a vision. I went, hang on, Capital Radio owns a theatre, the Duke of York's Theatre. I make the promos that go, see Pink Floyd in concert with 95.8 Capital FM. And I thought, so I've got this huge promotion vehicle that I work for. And I went to Richard Park, and this is an extraordinary destiny moment. I said, Richard, you know I do these hypnotism shows. And he goes, yes, I've heard about it, Paulie, yes, yes. I said, we own a theatre, right? He goes, yes. I said, I make these promos. Is there any chance, do you think, that Capital would give me a deal? And he said, he sat back in his chair, and he said, I'll back you, Paulie. Now, I think all success in life comes down to people backing you. If you've got a shop, your customers, they back you by going in there. If you're a politician, your voters back you, you know. And so that was a moment where my life changed. And I went and I had to borrow half a year's salary from the bank to put on two shows. Of course, all the DJs were plugging my promo. And first week, I sort of sold half the theatre. Next week, I sold it out. And I did a run of shows, and I thought, God, I love this. I like being a stage performer, because, you know, I had to learn how to do that. Because, you know, having been a DJ, you sit in a box and talk to people, but actually walk out on the stage, and I'd watch people who were charismatic and sort of studied them. So I was doing these shows at the Duke of York's on a Sunday and doing Capital Radio the rest of the time. And TV producer knocked on my dressing room door one evening, a guy called Paul Smith. His shows are Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and many other successful shows. And he says, I've been looking for you for 10 years. And I said, what do you mean by that? He went, I've wanted to do a hypnotism show on television for a decade, but I haven't been able to find the right kind of person, because most of the hypnotists are guys with goatee beards and black shirts buttoned up to the top who like make poodles out of balloons down the end of a pier. And he said, you will work on television. I said, okay. So things seem to be going rather well. I then get a call from Radio 1 saying, come in and see us. I was offered a job. And I went to see Richard Park, and, you know, it was kind of a sad sort of moment, because Richard had been so good to me, and I felt a bit bad about it. I rang Richard up, and I said, can I take you out to lunch? And he went, absolutely. And people said, weren't you scared? I went, yeah. But we ended up becoming really great friends. And I said, you know, I want to thank you for all that you did for me. Even now, you know, when I see Richard, I kind of like to sometimes talk about the old times. And, you know, but he very much looks forward. You know, he's one of the people who's very grateful for everything he's achieved, I think. You know, I find that a particularly brilliant quality. Roger Moore had that. I think, I don't know that well, Michael Caine has that. You know, people of that sort of era that grew up, you know, in those times are very grateful for everything they have now. I find people who take it all for granted, I think it's a deeply unattractive quality. But Richard has that. He's charismatic, he's dynamic. In some ways, he's quite humble, actually. He takes his job seriously. He likes being the best, you know. And so if anyone deserves to run a radio station, it's Richard Park.
You probably heard Gary been doing this whilst he was sitting in for Steve Wright over the last couple of weeks. You are the posse. The question is today, if you knew that the end of the world was in 1 week, what would you do? If you knew the end of the world was in 1 week, what would you do? Phone us and fax us now, because we'd love to hear from you.
And so I went off to Radio 1, because I thought I couldn't say no to it. Because it was fantastic as well. I mean, they had these beautiful studios in Acton House. SSL faders, they had EMT turntables. These turntables, well, as you cue the record up, you hit a button and the turntable goes backwards, right? It's like, and it's got this massive motor like a washing machine underneath it. ITC cart machines, beautiful studio complex. Because Capital was a very formatted sound, right? Richard wanted it to have a particular sound. Radio 1 was a set of personalities, you know, with records in between, right? And in fact, I remember one of the producers saying to me, do you think you could speak a bit more? You know, because I was doing these rather tight links because I just come from Capital, where that's what we did. I then, you know, got back into that whole sort of personality sound, which I'd, you know, very much tried to develop at Chilton. And you're doing gags and playing in all sorts of different jingles and effects and stuff like that. And I was doing a weekend earlies, and I was still doing the hypnotism shows. And I was doing a lot more of them now. And then Paul Smith arranged for me to do a pilot for ITV. So I woke up one morning and I thought, I've got to make a choice. I can't continue to do both because I'm exhausted from it. But I've either got to be a DJ and be a broadcaster, or I'm going to be a hypnotist. And I hadn't actually, we hadn't signed anything with ITV, but I went to see Johnny Beerling, who's, he was a lovely man. He's a lovely man. He's a controller of Radio 1. And I said, Johnny, I'm terribly sorry, but I'm going to have to leave. He went, oh, come on, Paul. Yeah, they all try this one. You'll get a better show later. Don't worry. I've got big plans for you. I went, no, I'm not joking. I said, I'm going off to become a hypnotist. He goes, I know you did this hypnotism thing. I said, yeah, but that's what I have to do. I could tell he was pissed off. But he went, all right. And he walked me to the door and shook hands. And I had this feeling like this, this feeling in my stomach, like, and I went, what the hell have I done? Nobody resigns from Radio 1. I think Noel Edmonds was the only ever person to have ever resigned, right, and gone on to television. I mean, everyone else waits till it's time and then they moved on. I remember thinking, this is, what the hell have I done here? Now, it's that fortune favours the brave. When you commit to something, it's a great quote, I think it's by Goethe, about how the universe turns in your favour. And I'd made a bold commitment to becoming a hypnotist. Suddenly, ITV say, right, we want you to do a special, a hypnotism special. And so I went and recorded this TV show. Paul Smith made he's a brilliant producer. We didn't get along, by the way, but I have to say, he's a totally brilliant TV producer. And I thought this is a pretty good TV show we've made. And they stuck it out on a bank holiday up against a Tom Cruise movie, and it slaughtered it. The show got something like 12 million viewers, right? I went to sleep that night, and the next day I couldn't walk down the street without people stopping me. And I wasn't really quite prepared for it all. You know, people would jump out of bushes and take photographs. Now, I was a little bit overwhelmed by it at first. Literally, also, my phone would not stop ringing. It just, I thought, crikey, this is all a bit overwhelming. I think about it also, I had no idea. I was just sort of making up as I went along. You know, I had a sort of direction. You know, I knew I wanted to be on television. I wanted to be a hypnotist. And the TV show was played all over the world. And so, you know, I'd walk down the street in Hong Kong and people would point at me, go, the magic man, you know, in Scandinavia, Australia, all kinds of places like that. You know, I was known by people. And so it was, yeah, it's kind of what I wanted, but I didn't know quite what it was. And in fact, funny enough, I said to a couple of my friends who are very famous, we were having a conversation a couple of years ago, and I said, the fame or the money? They went, oh, the money. In fact, one of them went, if I could give the fame back, I would, but I can't undo it now. It's a really interesting, and there's different kinds of fame, I think. You know, there's like, someone like the Kardashians have a sort of tabloid fame. Dan Brown's probably one of the most famous authors in the world. I couldn't tell you what he looks like. And then within, say, the world of, I don't know, plastic surgeons, there will be a surgeon who is particularly famous or something like that. But this was, it was sort of, you know, that fame of a different kind. And I quite liked it. You know, I enjoyed, more than anything, I was driven by artistic perfection. In fact, I drive everyone crazy around me when I'm such a perfectionist. So I wanted to be the best television broadcaster I could, as well as just the hypnotist. So I actually took the whole job of seeing how I came across on television very seriously and understanding a lot of the technicality.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Paul McKenna.
One of the things that was interesting was, you know, hypnotism very much involves language. And so I became much more aware of my language patterns.
Thank you very much. Good evening.
And I incorporated them to some extent into my broadcasting. So I wasn't hypnotizing the listeners, but what I was doing was I was making my words, or the words that I used, you know, make the sound of my shows more appealing. A good example of a good wordsmith in terms of a DJ was Roger Scott. And I didn't particularly feel one way or the other about Roger Scott until I worked with him. And then I suddenly realized how brilliant he was and why everyone else really rated him. He was very much the DJ's DJ.
For substitute for Val Doonigan, I know Bob Lind, Elusive Butterfly, Sunday night. It's 5 past 11, Radio 1 FM. Heartbreakers, head shakers, foot snappers, and finger tappers. Feeling groovy, the 59th Street Bridge song, his Harper's Bazaar.
Slow down. And I used to just love, you know, hanging out with Kenny Everett. And it was still one of the things I just thought was so much fun. He had this flat around in Lexham Gardens, and he had a beautiful studio there. He had this like an old BBC desk, and he had a couple of SB-10s and some AAT Studers tape machines. And here's an example of why Kenny Everett was such a genius. Like, one day I went around to see him, and he put on a record, a 33 record, at 78. So it was going really fast, right? It was, of course, it was a Beatles record. It sounded, so John Lennon sounded like Pinky Perky. And he put it through a device called an SPX-90, which lowered the pitch of the thing.
You remember this terribly expensive machine I bought last week that what it does is...
It's a perfectly normal tune.
So it lowered John Lennon's voice down to it sounding its normal tone, but just singing really, really fast. And he said, you see that? He said, yeah. He said, I haven't thought of a use for it yet. And I thought, how brilliant. So what he does is, he just mucks around, and then he goes, I'll find a use for that later. Heston Blumenthal, the chef, the amazing chef, a friend of mine, he did a similar sort of thing. You know, he'll heat an egg up to some temperature or something, or do something just to see what happens. And Kenny would be proper funny. Just things like, him and Freddie Mercury had had an argument. I believe it was about cocaine. And Kenny said to me, he goes, I hate cocaine. He goes, oh, you get all, you know, wired, don't you? You know, and he said, do you know the other thing I hate? Woolly jumpers. He goes, you know, I got the touch of them on my skin. Ooh, they make me feel, ooh. He goes, if God wants to punish me, he'll send me back as a coke-snorting sheep. So can you imagine just that he would talk like this all day long, and it would just be, he couldn't help but be funny, but also very kind of wise. I mean, I remember I went off to tour Australia and then New Zealand, and got back, and we went for lunch, this lovely restaurant where I go to a lot now called Maggie Jones. He said, so darling, how did you find it, Australia, New Zealand? I went, well, so I quite liked Australia, but New Zealand, I'll set your watch back to like 1952. I said, you know, it's nice waterfalls and mountains and clean air, but it's a bit dull, you know, wasn't many clubs. And he goes, oh, the voice of youth, you know. And of course he's right, you know, things that, like, you know, but also he would explain things to me like classical music. You know, he goes, I think we sort of, when we grow up on pop music, but when we get really grown up, we can understand classical music. And we'd listen to some piece, and he'd go, oh, listen, it's like a waterfall, darling, isn't it? And then things like, he showed me, he goes, I've just seen the most amazing thing ever. We watched what's called a Mandelbrot set, which is these fractal patterns that are infinite, right? And he went, isn't that like the most beautiful thing you've ever seen? I went, yeah, it's kind of cool, isn't it? But it was just this passion he had for things. He was very wise in lots of ways.
If I ever do die, I think as I'm hoiked aloft in a ray of God's lovely sunbeam, I think I'd like this to be on the gramophone as I go.
In fact, actually, I remember the day that he announced it. And I went round to see him and I said, how are you doing? He goes, do you know, I'm all right. All right, I've got more friends than I realised. He said, do you know what's weird thing? Michael Winner. Michael Winner rang me up and he said, Kenny, I don't know you, but I'm very, very saddened by this news. I've always admired you and think you're a very talented man. Is there anything you need? Do you need money? Do you need me to come around and make you a cup of tea? And Kenny said, no. He says, do you know what? Just you ringing up has made the difference today, and I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And he said, I didn't know him. I didn't know from Adam. Didn't know what he was like. What a lovely thing. And you know, I mean, when he got sick and when he died, it was just so awful. It was truly awful. And even now, you know, I miss Kenny, actually. He was one of those people that was, even though he burned bright, just not for very long, or not for long enough. And last time I ever saw him, it was here, actually. And I had a little party. And, you know, came round and he walked into the room. And, you know, by then everyone knew that he had AIDS and everything. It was because it was all over the news. So he came to a party here and he walked into the room. But it's one of the things I think people didn't know what to say. David Jensen goes over and gives him a hug. And then everybody hugged Kenny. And he was quite frail by this stage. And then we went downstairs. He goes, I'm a bit tired. And he turned to me and he said, I want you to know you're a wonderful human being, and hugged me, and that was the last time I ever saw him. And he didn't want people to see him at the end. He wanted them to remember him as he was, you know. And so, you know, that's one of the things that I feel sad about, is because he'd been such a positive influence, and so kind to me. Yeah, that's one of the things, I think, you know, is the Dalai Lama says, kindness is my religion. If that's all you can ever do in life is be kind to other people, I think that is a fantastic achievement. You know, I'd seen a lot of cruelty in my childhood at Catholic school, which had given me a taste for compassion. but also because I'd been roughed up, I think it left me a little bit, as a person, I wasn't shy of a scrap. But I would often argue with people, you know, to get my own way. And I hope that, that's not the case nowadays, because I don't really want to be that guy. But people did say to me, you know, Paul, you got to watch your temper, things like that. And the other thing is, I'm one of those people that's convinced I'm right very often. I'm not so much now, because I'm married to a woman who's much smarter than I am. So, I'm prepared to believe I don't know it all. Again, that's another thing, being young. I was convinced I knew everything, you know. And I'm very idealistic as well. Whereas I hope I become more pragmatic. In fact, the older I get, the more I realise that I really don't know that much. I was saying to my wife yesterday, I think we go through sort of cycles, like 5 to 7 years. And if you look at, say, radio, the Capital Radio of the 70s was not the Capital Radio of the 80s. And then, of course, in the mid-80s, when Richard Park shows up, it becomes a whole new thing. And the Capital Radio that you listen to now is not the same as it was in the 90s or the noughties. And in the same way, my life, I think, if I look at it, look back, of every sort of 5 to 7 years, it's gone through a sort of another shift and a cycle. There's a friend of mine, a wonderful man called General Graham Lamb. He says he thinks of it as chapters. He goes, which chapter are you on now, Paul, in your life? You know? And so I've just opened up a new chapter now. I've been living in Los Angeles for a decade. And I was enjoying living in LA. But I became friends with this legendary producer. He's the most fantastic guy called Robert Evans. There's a brilliant documentary, it's my favourite documentary, about him called The Kid Stays in the Picture. He ran Hollywood in the sort of the 70s, you know. He made The Godfather, he made True Grit, he made Love Story, Anyway, I got a call one day saying, Bob, I'd really like to meet you. I went, oh my God, Bob Evans, yes! Right? So I go over and we hang out and we end up becoming friends. And I go see him a couple of times a week and we're just, and he's got this brilliant mind. And, I tried to drive him mad with too many questions, but I just can't help it. I mean, because he's, Bob Evans. And one day he says, he's got this great voice, he says, Henry Kissinger once said to me, Paul, make 3 circles. The first one, that's a big circle, that's your acquaintances. The second one, smaller, that's your friends. And then the smallest one of all, that's your real friends. People will be there for you, you got to be there for them. So I went away and did this. I got more real friends than I realized. But the majority of my real friends, even though I do have some real friends in Los Angeles, the majority of my real friends are here in Europe. So either here in the UK or in France or Spain or Italy, etc. My wife found it very hard to make friends in LA. So we decided to come back. And I'm living back in the UK. I had a terrific time while I was there. But, the kind of person I was when I showed up was match fit for that town because I was very ambitious, very focused. And also, it's the kind of place, Los Angeles, is great if you're doing well. And I took a punt. I didn't have a job. And, I bought a house and I decided I've got to be there to make it happen. And again, certain people were kind to me, like Simon Cowell has always been very kind to me. He's a wonderful man, very generous. And he was very helpful to me. And so, I then became friends with lots of other really cool people like Ryan Seacrest, I became great friends with. I think Ryan is just one of the greatest broadcasters, certainly one of the hardest working people in show business. I remember Steve Wright saying to me a couple of years ago, he said, that Ryan Seacrest, I think he might be the best DJ in the world, Paul, I said, yeah, I think he is, actually.
All right, let's go to Lady Gaga. She was connected on a 310 number, but she's in Amsterdam. So I've never been to Amsterdam myself. Have you, Ellen? Have you ever been there?
I've never been. I would love to go. Everyone who goes loves it.
Hi, Gaga.
Hi, guys. Hi, Ryan. Hi, Ellen.
I used to go in and watch Ryan do the Kiss morning show. He's got this fantastic studio, right? But he has a gold microphone, right? And I said, why is it that everyone uses these sweepers, that just go 102.7 Kiss FM? I said, I like the jingles, the da 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 102.7 Kiss FM.
Music Radio Kiss FM.
So I would sit in and watch him, and he's great energy. He listens on these little headphones like you get from Walkman. I prefer. Beyer DT100s are just, fantastic. I love them. Yeah, so I'm still a massive anorak. Even in all the years when I was working as a hypnotist, now it's all so digital. And in fact, the studios now, like the new global studios, are amazing. I was in at Heart the other day. It's like going in a spaceship. I mean, it's all beautifully white. But it's also lit for television because they're going to use the clips on social media because, it's not just audio, it's video. I actually really quite like just the audio medium. Of course, it's the Terry Wogan description, isn't it? That you paint pictures in the imagination with the words. You know, say an aeroplane is carrying a cherry and it drops this cherry into a sea of cream and the cream bounces everywhere and the aeroplane banks off into the distance and the sunshine sparkles on the silver wings of the plane. Now, in order to create that visually costs quite a bit of money, but you know, you can do it in, you know, in your imagination through words. I mean, Howard Stern said to me, he said, I've got a canvas, a blank canvas, right? I'm going to paint pictures in people's minds on that canvas. And so for a while I used to appear on Howard Stern's show and he'd always, he'd always come up with something. He'd come up with a list of things, half of them I couldn't possibly do. So on Howard, this is just too outrageous. But what was really brilliant about him, why he's one of the great broadcasters, is you start with like nothing. And he's so creative, he's very intelligent. Like a lot of those guys, you know, he's much more gentle in real life. When he opens the mic, he kind of comes alive and is more edgy. You know? But I admired him very much as a broadcaster. You know, as a shock jock, that's his whole thing.
All right, let me get the minor complaints out of the way.
Yeah, out of the way.
The minor complaints are we don't have an office. The facility, you know, the K-Rock studios aren't exactly modern.
Yeah.
But wait a second, I don't want to be negative here because I love K-Rock.
Mm. We like working with the older equipment.
Yeah, let me just say something. K-Rock. If I could jam my tongue into K-Rock's throat right now, I would.
My love of radio never went away. I mean, even when I'd be driving up and down the country doing touring, whenever I'm anywhere, I'm always listening to the local stations. One of my friends, David Bovington, says to me, someone's bought the Ross Revenge. It's parked in the River Blackwater, isn't it? And if you're alumni, if you were on the station, one weekend a month, you can go back to the ship and you've got a transmitter now and everything. So I said, God, this sounds like so much fun. So I got in touch with Kevin Turner, who's the program director. I said, Kev, I understand we come back to the station, right? And he goes, yeah. He says, do you want to come? I went, hell yes. This is going to be so much fun. So we meet in the marina. And it's people I haven't seen in 34 years. It's kind of like spooky. And I've got some photos from 1984 when I was there. We're having a good rack looking at those. We get on the tender and we go out to the Ross. It was wonderful, but it was also a bit eerie because it's extraordinary because it hasn't changed. I mean, the only thing that has changed is the galley, which they've made it a lot nicer. Because, I mean, back in the day, I mean, you could have made some weapons of mass destruction in there. So some of the food was a bit rum. Anyway, we get on the boat. You know, it was like it was yesterday. Of course, I left radio in 1990. I've never used a playout system before, right? But I thought, how difficult can it be? Well, it turns out it wasn't as easy as I thought. So they say, look, we can let you have a practice. 20 minutes into this, I have a little freak out because I think, my God, I'm going to make such an ass of myself tomorrow if I'm not careful. Everyone else takes it really seriously as well, right? You know, they're really into it. You know, somebody said to me, why on earth would you want to go back and do that? I said, look, it's like this. You're into golf. Someone lends you Glen Eagles for the weekend. You know, it's just so anyway, so I'm there with all these other great broadcasters and I'm thinking this isn't going to work. Anyway, I practiced and practiced, had a couple of glasses of red wine, relaxed a bit, and then suddenly I began to be able to do it, automatically hit the buttons and move the faders without having to think about it, you know, so it sort of came back, but I had to think of them as cart machines really, although I was still you're very happy that one of the other jocks was in the studio just in case I'd forgotten how you did this or that. Weirdest thing, I just I opened them up. Oh, I thought I was last here in 1984. What was going on then? You know, Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister. Ghostbusters was the big hit movie of that year. Virgin Atlantic did their inaugural flight. And of course, Boys of Summer was playing on the radio.
It was 1984 when I was last here. Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister. It was the year of Band-Aid and Ghostbusters. The Apple Mac computer went on sale. Virgin Atlantic's inaugural flight took place, and this was playing all over the radio.
So I did. So I opened up the mic, and it was, you know, did that. I love doing Top of the Hour. I did broadcasting on, you know, six, whatever it is, on around the world on the internet. This is Radio Caroline. Ding ding. Where the time is exactly 12 o'clock.
Broadcasting to the UK, Europe, and around the world on the internet, and on 1368 kilohertz, courtesy of Manx Radio. This is Radio Caroline, where the time now is 2 o'clock. Paul McKenna.
and it just felt so good. Whew, that first link out of the way, and it went great. I mean, I loved it, but I was nervous. I didn't want to make a mistake, because I take it seriously, just as all the rest of them do. They, it was very interesting. It wasn't just that it was great to be broadcasting again. It was the camaraderie. And that's what I remember from the ship, because you're in a confined space with people and you kind of need to get along. And so certain things can be amplified. You know, if you have an argument or something like that, it's a bigger deal because you're all living together. But because we're all there for the same reason, just because we all love it, there's something really extraordinary. Athletes call it being in the zone. Musicians call it being in the groove. Psychologists call it being in the flow. And, you know, when you're really enjoying yourself, you're involved in a task that's not too easy, but it's not too difficult, and it consumes you, the rest of the world sort of disappears.
This is a global podcast. Hello, this is Paul McKenna, and welcome to the Positivity Podcast. My objective is to interview the most...
I suppose the other radio job I have at the moment is I do a podcast, where I interview, the objective is to interview the most interesting, some of the most interesting people in the world, but in a non-journalistic way. You know, it's basically, how do you do what you do? And without directly asking this question, I go, what's your success mindset? So, you know, people I've interviewed so far are Simon Cowell, Roger Daltrey, Gary Lineker, Warwick Davis, Rob Brydon. I'm interviewing Karen Brady in a few weeks, Louis Walsh this week. You know. My questions are all around sort of, what's it like being you? How do you see the world? How do you overcome, you know, obstacles? And, you know, did you have a goal? Those sorts of things. You're hearing them say things you would never normally hear them say in an interview because, you know, in fact, Simon Cowell's publicist said, you know, I've never heard half that stuff. I said, yeah, I've known him 25 years. I've never heard it either.
One thing you never, ever, ever do is go onto the comments because they're vile. These are people who are sitting in dark rooms anonymously writing horrible things about you. Why do I want to read that?
How would I like to be remembered? Do you know, I mean, in a way, I'm driven. My life feels worthwhile. I think it's important to have a purpose. Viktor Frankl, the legendary psychiatrist who survived Auschwitz, wrote Man's Search for Meaning. He said, purpose is the cornerstone of good mental health. Part of me thinks, yeah, sure, I want to achieve things in life. But kind of when I'm dead, I really kind of don't care. Because, I mean, I'd like my work to continue on. In fact, I'm making arrangements for the, you know, so that all my work will be available to everyone in perpetuity, I hope. I'd like to think that people would think of me in a good way, I suppose. I don't want to be thought of as an evil, bad person. I mean, but I'm not that fussed. I mean, I say to people when they've lost somebody and I want to make them feel better, I say, well, would they want you to be sad? Now, you should be sad if somebody dies because, you know, someone you love is gone. And so, you know, if you don't feel bad, how can you have any sense of value? But they wouldn't want you to be sad, right? And when I die, I want everyone to be very sad. I want a state funeral, faces of my detractors put on television and captioned with something like, are you sorry now about what you said about him? I suppose I'd like to be remembered. Actually, do you know, it's very interesting. A friend of mine said to me the other day, who is it says? Was it the ancient Egyptians? Basically, you have two deaths, your physical death, and when people stop saying your name.